open, and we're welcoming some of our House colleagues today for the quarterly economic forecasts. And we have our two presenters, our state economists. Josh, you guys want to come on up? And we'll get rolling.
Thank you, Senator Haas, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mark McMullen, the state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, joined as always by my colleague, Josh Lehner, to give our quarterly update on the economic and revenue outlook. So in terms of recent performance, Oregon's economy continues to grow at a healthy pace, as do our primary sources of state tax revenue, keeping up, you know, every bit with our expectations that we've laid over the last year or two. For the most part, really all is well at this point. However, we are starting to see some cracks show up in terms of the nationwide economic expansion. We're starting to see some warning signs, and in particular, a couple of those that bear on Oregon, disproportionately so, given Oregon's industrial mix. And so our eyes are open going forward, but for right now, the threats are pretty much contained. In fact, our advisory groups felt very strongly this time that we shouldn't overdo the pessimism and the negativity, just given that to date we were really still seeing good numbers for the most part. So at the U.S. level, the first chart shows business cycle indicators at the U.S. level. These are the four indicators that the National Bureau of Economic Research, a think tank in Boston, uses to date business cycles, to say when we are in a recession and when the economy, the U.S. economy, is growing. They don't have an exact formula to combine these things, but this is what they claim they use: employment, production, income, and manufacturing and trade sales. And as you see, for the most part, everything's still up and to the right in happy territory, all except for one. And one of these things is not like the others, and that would be industrial production, where we've seen a halt in growth in industrial production earlier, or in 2015. In the beginning of 2015, we really saw the end of the expansion here. In fact, you know, the declines or the rate of growth right now in terms of industrial production is at, it's never been this low in an expansion. Typically, when we're losing manufacturing production at this rate, we're already well within a recession. But that's clearly not true right now, and we'll talk a little bit about how this time is different. But no, nevertheless, it's obvious that manufacturing is weak, and it came to pass right at the same time as we saw commodity prices and energy prices drop, and at the same time we saw our terms of trade, the exchange rate of the dollar increase, or the strength of the dollar increase by quite a bit. And so this has put pressure on some of our manufacturers, particularly in energy and commodity related industries. And we see that the pipeline looks rough as well in terms of what manufacturers are ordering down the line. Of course, we're still a place that makes a lot of goods, Oregon, so this is something we look at very closely. However, to date, the Oregon numbers have not shown the same kind of weakness that we've seen in the U.S. While still a threat, hours worked by manufacturing workers are still in healthy territory and are not weakening at all. The supply chain and orders for our technology industries are not great. They're flat, but they're not declining like they do during a typical contraction. And we're seeing still healthy employment situation as well, and wages in manufacturing, among manufacturing workers. So for now, it looks like the Oregon-specific numbers are doing well, but there is certainly this threat on the horizon. But if we look at all leading indicators in together in terms of tea leaves and things that tend to lead economic activity, so far most of this weakness is really concentrated in measures that capture goods production or manufacturing and haven't spread to the broader economy. And I'll pass it along to Josh to talk a little bit about indicators.
Thanks, Mark. Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner, economic analysis. And that's right. Overall, we have two composite leading indicator series here in the state of Oregon, the one our office produces and the one that the University of Oregon produces. And they've become a much more of a mixed bag in the last year. They're relatively flat over the last year or so. And that's really two different things going on. We'll talk some more about the goods producing and the manufacturing ones here in a second. But everything else outside of that is continues to be very, very robust. Labor market in particular, what you see in front of you, these are U.S. numbers, but they're initial claims for unemployment insurance. It's a measure of layoffs or firings in the economy. We were literally at a historic low in those just a couple months ago. It's ticked up just a hair, but you can see the it's quite a noisy series. So It's still very, very healthy rates of layoffs in the economy. Oregon numbers are very, very similar. We have data going back to the 80s at the state level and the 70s and whatnot at the U.S. level. And even at the size of the economy we are today, we're still at historic lows in terms of firings. And this is probably the best single leading indicator we have because businesses start laying off people when they start to see their orders decline and their sales declines and things like that. You start to see a run-up in both the initial claims and also the unemployment rate ahead of a recession. We're not seeing that yet. Other leading indicators that continue to do well in the labor market would be temporary workers. Temporary agencies continue to boom. One of our advisors, one of his clients, is a temporary agency, and he has nothing but good news to report from that sector. Again, when businesses see their sales slow and orders decline, they typically let go their contractors and their temp workers first because then they don't have to deal with the HR headaches of actually, dealing with their own staff first. Also, withholdings out of Oregonian paychecks continue to be very, very robust, near double-digit growth. Furthermore, housing starts are still on the upswing, and new business formations at the state continue to pick up. Entrepreneurship is on the rebound a little bit after coming off of some very, very low numbers post-recession. So there's a lot of really good things going on in the economy. However, as Mark said, some of those dark clouds are forming a little bit just around the manufacturing sector, and that's a bit worrisome, particularly As Mark said, the decline we're seeing in industrial production nationwide right now of about 2% year over year. So the amount we're producing today relative to a year ago is about 2% lower. Every single time the U.S. has seen this in the last 50, 60 years, we've already been in recession. It's not a leading indicator at this point. We're already in recession, but given the myriad data points that are out there, we are not in recession today. This seems to be an outlier, at least so far. You can see here what we've tried to show in the blue bars that go up, the different subsectors within manufacturing. You can decompose it into 20 different things. You got your semiconductors, you have your automobiles, you have your aerospace, your oil and gas extraction, your mining industries. You separate all these out together. How many of them are actually seeing declines? And right now, it's only 6 or 7 subsectors are seeing these declines. Even though the top number is really bad, it's still contained within things that are concentrated in the oil and gas industries. And then the table on the right shows you every other time we've been in a similar situation at the top line number, how many of those subsectors are declining year over year. It's 3/4 of them. And in recessions, we see losses in every manufacturing sector. We're not seeing that today. Again, automobiles are still up. Semiconductors are still up. Furniture is still up. There's a whole range of them that are still growing, and that's good news. But the weakness coming out of the oil and gas sector and the related things like pipe makers and things like that feed directly into it is certainly worrisome, and it's certainly a really large drag on the economy, and it's hurting places like North Dakota and Texas. It's not hurting Oregon so much. We had one firm that announced layoffs and closures in Portland due to they supplied some of the metal makers and machinery that went into primarily the oil and gas industry in Canada. So we've had one direct linkage to this, but this weakness is really contained in the energy-producing states, Wyoming, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Louisiana, places like that have the energy sector. That's where this weakness is. Now, to the extent that it spreads further and you get some sort of contagion effect, then we're talking about something much different. But again, there's certainly this weakness that's out there. We think it's still relatively contained within specific parts of the state or parts of the country, and within certain manufacturing sectors at the same time.
So given Oregon's lack of exposure directly to energy production, like the states that are weakening and the industries here that are weakening, that, directly gives us, is somewhat encouraging. What worries us is, or the biggest threat here is indirect. And part of the reason we've seen our dollar strengthened so much in terms of Oregon's trading partners and the terms of trade vis-a-vis the countries that we do most of our trade with, we're looking at an exchange rate that hasn't been this high since the Asian financial crisis, and that's clearly a problem for us and the competitiveness of our local firms. So the concern for us is indirect, that when we see the commodity prices drop, well, that weakens the currencies of a lot of the developing world, and we're seeing weak currency conditions in China as well. And so with this strong dollar and the weak currency, what does it do? It comes back and it hurts our traded sector, which is clearly of great import to Oregon. And this is the most depressing number that's out there right now, which is the growth in our exports of non-technology products. So, and this is across a broad range. Here we're looking at nearly 20% year-over-year declines in Oregon's exports. So the stronger dollar is already hitting. The worst off so far are agriculture and food products are down about 35% year-over-year. But it's really a wide range of our export products. Metals, machinery, forest and wood products, those are all down on the order of 15% year-over-year. So it's already starting to manifest itself here in some weaker trade numbers as well. So we're not immune just because we're not a big energy producer from this. But so far, again, the weakness has been localized. And for the most part, the numbers are positive. In particular, Oregon's labor market numbers continue to impress. I know we've shown this chart the last few times we've been here to just to hammer home the point that in every expansion since World War II, Oregon has outperformed the typical state in the U.S. in terms of job growth in particular and output growth as well. And we have that traditional advantage back now. All the numbers are still quite strong. We have well over a percentage point growth advantage relative to the typical state, and our jobs are growing as fast as they did during the housing boom. Primary reasons for this are we have had strength to date in our goods producers, and we also have seen our traditional advantage in terms of migration snapback. Hordes of households are moving to Oregon, retirees from California, as well as prime working age households moving to our metropolitan areas. So going into it, coming through in terms of recent performance, it's still quite a good story, even though there are starting to be some concerns at the U.S. level.
And these job gains that we're seeing at the statewide level have now spread out to the entire state. You can see here sort of what is the typical growth rate these different regions within Oregon see during economic expansions in the 80s and the 90s, the housing boom, and then in the last 2 years is the red bar. You can see here every region of the state is growing today, adding jobs at about the same pace as they historically have. There's some variation over time, of course. Places like Bend, it seems like the natural expansion rate in Central Oregon is 6 to 8% a year, astronomical numbers. But, you know, everywhere else it's more like 2 to 3%. And you can see here that growth is spread out. It's even across the place. The Gorge isn't currently adding jobs, but given their strength, they tend to be more stable than the state overall over the business cycle. And considering how well they did in 2008 through 2012, they're still at an all-time high for jobs in this data series anyway. So they're slowing down in their growth rate, but they're one of the best performing regions in the whole state. So I'm not too concerned about that. But you can see job growth has returned to our rural areas as well. Of course, if you started looking where we were a decade ago to where we are today, the performance has been very uneven, with the metropolitan areas, Portland in particular, now being at all-time highs historically, with some of our more rural areas, southwestern part of the state and the southeastern part of the state, still remain substantially below where they were a decade ago. Job growth has returned. However, not even half of the job losses have been regained in a lot of our southern counties outside of Medford and Grants Pass. They're almost all the way back to where they were. They just now are surpassing where they were at the start of the recession. So this is really good news. This is where some of our strength in our labor market numbers are coming from, is the fact that the growth has spread out to everywhere in the state. And we're starting to see good numbers, even if even if the 10-year performance varies considerably across the different regions. And most importantly, and more importantly along these lines, is this job growth and these strong economic numbers we're seeing here in the state of Oregon is translating into higher incomes. What you see here are two different measures of income relative to the U.S. average. We've shown this before with you. A lot of the focus has been on the per capita personal income. That's the light blue numbers you see there relative to the U.S. It's fallen considerably since the early 80s, and it's starting to turn around a little bit in the last few years with our stronger economy, but it remains 10% below the U.S. average. However, juxtaposed to that is our average wages. Our average wages in Oregon have always been lower than the U.S., but they are now outperforming the typical state. We've taken, you know, a few percentage points step up in terms of our average wage relative to the typical state, and we've never seen this high of an average wage relative to the U.S. Since the mills closed in the early 1980s. It's been more than a generation since we've seen this strong of wage gains and wage growth relative to the typical state, and so this is really encouraging that we're seeing this spread out across the entire state as well.
The difference between personal income and average wage?
Per capita personal income is total amount of income in the state of Oregon divided by all people. So you add up, you know, retirees and babies and all that, you know, divide the income. Average wage is wages and salaries divided by the number of jobs. So it's you're only focusing on the people that actually have a job, not the retirees or the babies.
So the rich get to offset the poor. Mm-hmm.
So again, we're seeing these stronger labor market numbers, and it's turning into stronger income numbers. And if you decompose these average wages, it's not some sort of compositional effect where we're adding a lot of high-wage attorneys and doctors and things like that in Portland, where average wages are higher and in certain industries they're higher. Average wages are up in every county and every major industry, so it really is broad-based. Of course, there's some that are growing faster than others. You know, software jobs are growing at faster rates than leisure and hospitality average wages. But at the same time, we're seeing it really broad-based and spread out across the state, which is, again, most encouraging about these numbers. And then the other thing that's going on is we're pulling workers back into the labor force. Here we're talking about the share of adults in the state of Oregon that either have a job or are actively looking for work. So the employed plus the unemployed as a share of the overall population. That's what the labor force is. It's been declining for 15 years. But it should have been declining for 15 years due to the demographics. We have, as the baby boomers age into the retirement years, it's weighing on these numbers. And so that's why we put a demographically adjusted line up there, the dashed gray line. That is if the economy was operating at full capacity, firing on all cylinders, that is where the labor force participation rate would be today. You can see the red line is below the gray line, and that gap between the two is what we're most concerned about. However, we're starting to come off of our recessionary lows. You can see in 2014, the red line turned up. We started to gain a little bit more labor force participation. The 2015 numbers, you see the wiggle there where it plunged and then came right back up in the last 12 months. Part of that, I think, is just due to some underlying noise volatility in the data. The sample data is really small. That's going to be revised and released next month. We're going to get totally new 2015 data, revised data in a month, so we'll see what that looks like. But we're expecting this to come up a little bit because of the more plentiful job opportunities in the state of Oregon that are now paying higher average wages. It's bringing people back into the labor force in search of these jobs. And we go to the next one. This is what we're seeing. This is the share of people that aren't in the labor force, so they're not actively looking for a job, that actually find a job the next month. So 1 month, they're not interested in finding a job. The next month, hey, I have a job. And what this means is that businesses are starting to cast a wider net. We're hearing anecdotal stories from our advisors, and it's backed up by the data, that maybe a spouse is staying at home taking care of the house or the family, or maybe someone was on someone was injured for a little while, and they left the labor market. But then the neighbor, or maybe their old firm, or maybe a competitor of their old firm is looking for someone to hire, and they reach out and they say, hey, are you interested in taking this job? You know, just bypassing the whole posting online on Monster.com or Craigslist or what have you, and people are taking these jobs. You can see we reached an all-time low in terms of the share of people finding jobs a few years ago, but it's really increasing strongly in the past 18 months, and it's good news. This is where we're going to get some of this labor force participation bounce back from, is these people that are on the sidelines right now. Now these job opportunities are more plentiful. They're coming back in and finding jobs at a much higher rate than they had been in recent years. Don't expect this red line to go all the way back to where it was in the 1990s or 2000s, because so much of the knot in the labor force numbers are actual retirements of baby boomers. They're not going to come back once you're 67, 68. What we're more interested in are the people that are 40 or 50 years old coming back into the labor market and the like.
So that's certainly encouraging that we're getting this deeper labor market recovery, and people have been waiting for it. We've seen all this job growth, and they're like, well, but why are people still sitting on the sidelines? Are there skills mismatches or fundamental problems with the economy? And there certainly are some, but this would indicate that there's wages still do matter. And we were waiting until we finally started to see better wages and better pay. And sure enough, as soon as we started to see improvements in pay, here come the workers back in. So we're getting closer to what we would consider a full employment, healthy economy, which, you know, on its face is good in terms of our growth outlook. That's when we're going to start to see things slow. We start to lose this cyclical boost. In our baseline outlook for the state, we expect some rapid rates of employment growth that we're seeing today to persist for about a year more. And at that point, we've taken out a lot of this participation slack and a lot of the remaining slack that's left in the labor market. And then we expect a transition at that point, you see here, to much slower rates of growth, around 1%, things that are more sustainable over the medium and long term. As Josh mentioned, these demographic weights on our growth are real. And so we feel strongly that over the medium and long term, we're not going to be able to support the same kind of rates of growth that we've seen in recent months and in recent expansions. But that said, there's still some slack left. And as we take that up over the next year, we should continue to see some relatively encouraging numbers. And then these job numbers have certainly been reflected in our tax revenues, in our personal income tax revenues to date, which have been very healthy going forward. But unfortunately, we're going to see a little bit of a pullback in that, I think, over the next year or two. We really can't avoid the impact that falling corporate profits and the falling stock market prices are going to do to our personal and corporate income taxes going forward, and that's going to be reflected in the outlook we're going to show you now. For the most part, these equity markets and the losses we've seen in the value of household assets are going to weigh on our income tax streams, but for the most part, it's a 17, 19, and beyond phenomenon, given the timing, and I'll get a little bit more into that, those details as we go forward. But in terms of recent performance, personal income tax collections are still around 10% year over year. That's not biennium, that's year over year, 10%. And we've seen this now for over a year, about somewhere around these rates of strong growth. And this is across the board in terms of the different collections we get. The ones that are related to wages and salaries are withholding, are growing at nearly double-digit rates, around 9% year over year in terms of the money that's taken out of workers' paychecks. And we're still seeing plenty of growth in non-wage kinds of income and dividends and capital gains and business income and the like. So across the board, we're still looking at good, healthy tax collections that are still running a little bit ahead of our previous projections, or at least those that were made at the close of session. What we have started to see weakness in are the corporate income taxes. As you see here, the last few months, and this is smoothed over 12 months, we're starting to drop. Now we're dropping at about 25% year-over-year rate, although it's only just begun. And this is very much coordinated with a decline nationwide in corporate profitability. Corporate profits fell sharply, very much like the stock market, at about the same time, largely due to the strengthening dollar. As the U.S. dollar becomes stronger, this is really eating away at a lot of business margins and making them shorter. So the expectation is that these lower profits will put a weight on our corporate tax outlook going forward. It doesn't really change it fundamentally. We think we're going to level off somewhere in the $550 million a year range over the next year or two. But nevertheless, the weaker profit outlook that we're feeding in is going to take about $30 or $40 million per biennium relative to what we were showing in the last forecast.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been reading in the news about companies that have merged and moved their headquarters overseas or done other things for the purpose of reducing taxes in the United States. How does that impact this number, if at all?
Representative Barnard, Chair Hassett, this really offsets those numbers. To what extent you get a tax advantage from locating it out of taking a haven or locating your profits overseas for tax purposes, now when you repatriate that money, you're paying a 15% higher rate of moving the money back into dollars. So this offsets those advantages. It's a separate business cost, but it's moving in the opposite direction.
And let me follow up, if I may. I'm interested in that first effect. Many companies are apparently not moving the money back into the United States. And my impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that when the maneuvers that I described affect taxes, a reduction in their taxes in the United States, that also affects Oregon's tax receipts negatively. If I've misunderstood that, correct me. I'm wondering what proportion, what that reduction in the taxes that those companies pay in Oregon has as a portion of this number, of this downturn you're describing.
No, I see, Representative Barnard. Right now, not a lot, but the dynamic you've explained well, and it is significant. But in terms of the data right now, we haven't been able to isolate that. Hopefully, we'll get a little bit better idea of the Oregon firms that are operating in such a way as we start to study the results of the tax haven bills that you've recently passed. We'll start to get some numbers on that in a year or two, and hopefully we'll be able to get a little better idea of the firms that are operating like this in Oregon.
Yes, I'm sorry, Representative Benz.
Thank you. And to follow up on this trend, there has been some suggestion that the stronger dollar has been driven by the incredibly minute increase in interest rates by our Fed, and that this result that we see happening across America is going to result in her pedaling backwards and making a change to change what we're seeing up there. Let's assume she does it. And it should. We've seen this happen before, but this is like a replay of an old movie. Would you see that changing if she does indeed weaken the dollar through the backing up on the interest rates?
Representative Bentz, the Fed policy, as you say, right now is very, in terms of the magnitude, is very small, and so backing up, there's not very much room there to do it. But it certainly acts as a coordinating event. And just like the conventional wisdom was, as soon as the Federal Reserve was going to start to tighten policy, that was going to take the wind out of the equity market. People have been saying that for a couple of years, and sure enough, the day it happened, that it wasn't the quarter point or half a point that did it. It was the coordination of people's actions and their beliefs that pulled it back. So Fed policy certainly has a lot of power in terms of coordinating investors' and households' beliefs. Now, that said, the run-up in the dollar that we've seen so far is unequivocally not because of anything that the U.S. is doing or that the U.S. is strong, but that the rest of the world is so weak. And there's really lack of demand for the other currencies. And that's what's pushing up the dollar right now predominantly, is just the weakness abroad.
Follow-up? Thank you. So the challenge is disinflation, and that's what everyone is desperately worried about. Yeah. At least that's my take. So Little Oregon, we're just a casual observer. Is that your thought on this?
Yes, Representative Bentz. We are a casual observer, but disinflation would hurt us just like anywhere else. When the price is going to be of that car is going to be cheaper tomorrow than it is today, you're not going to buy it today. Or that investment, that machinery for your equipment, for your business. Oh, if it's going to be cheaper tomorrow, I'll just wait. And that's obviously a very scary thing for economic growth.
Okay, let's go ahead.
Hold on, Senator. Please.
Senator Boquist.
I was going to wait to the end, but since we jumped in the middle here. On your slide right here, in terms of all of the remaining, all of your economic indicators that input into this slide across the board, what happens if the tax that chart now becomes $5.2 billion.
Senator Boquist, Senator Haas, this would fundamentally change this relationship. This corporate taxes, although what 10% of them now are based on sales with Measure 67, the vast majority of this is still based on profitability, and in terms of the, you know, the, but the taxable income of corporations are. We, and as you've seen, this has been pretty flat over time up until the most recent period, or, you know, a lot of volatility, but somewhere stable. Moving to sales would be a fundamentally different relationship. And we're looking right now into some of the historical B&O data in Washington to try to figure out what, you know, get ahead of this and see what this would change. But, yes, these relationships and our models would have to be fundamentally rebuilt to be based on sales rather than on profits or income.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, just briefly.
Follow up.
So you don't have an answer?
No, Senator Boquist, it's still the great unknown. Until Alago's passed the governor's desk, it's Dr. Warner's problem.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, the governor doesn't have to sign an initiative petition 28 when it passes. Okay, I'm just pointing that out to you. Thank you.
All right, go ahead. In your slideshow.
So, here's the big issue, right? The economy's still growing fine. You know, our economic outlook is pretty much unchanged from 2 months ago when we were before this group last. The one thing that has changed is stock market performance. And as of our time of production, we were down, you know, roughly 10% from peak values in terms of our equity prices. And as we know, this, as an income tax state, this feeds directly into our primary revenue stream through capital gains, dividend income, and the like, capital gains being the biggest chunk. And so the largest changes we're going to see in the top line revenue numbers are really driven by this shift here. And as you see, we've taken the 10% haircut in terms of the stock price indicators, and that's dropped our capital gains and our overall personal income tax revenue by somewhere on the order of $75 to $100 million a year. But this could this is for a 10% correction, and as I say, most of this is pushed off into 2017, 2019 and 2021 bienniums rather than now. There are a couple of dynamics behind that. One would be idiosyncratic factors. We've had a lot of large businesses, the Standard and Precision Cast Parts and the lot sell in Oregon over the past year, and so this creates a lot of taxable events for owners of the stock. And so that will temporarily hold things up, as will some of the charitable contributions for the OHSU Cancer Center that we thought were going to land in tax year 2015. Some of those events are going to be seen in 2016, from what we understand. And so those temporary effects hold it up, but so does just the typical dynamic itself. As the prices are going down, a lot of investors are actually taking profits. They've held these stocks for a while. And so volume goes up as people take these profits, particularly in this first 10% of the equity drop. We've got a lot of people skimming off the top of money that they made. And so this artificially, or not artificially, it holds up our taxable capital gains realizations for some time. But then afterwards, that's when the hangover occurs. And now that we have a lack of stock of these gains, then the losses start to mount. And so as we go deeper down the stock market, and the last couple of days haven't been good, if we get deeper down into the pricing, we start to get more into losses. And then we start talking about carrying these losses forward into other tax years. And as you see here, in the extreme, our realized capital gains can swing all the way down to $2 billion from the, you know, 8, 9, 10 where we are today. And so there's still some downside risk here, but we have incorporated the haircut that we've taken to date. And that really does start to weigh on revenues in future biennia.
Excuse me, Mark, on this slide, Senator
Barcigar. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have this spike in 2015, and you alluded to the fact that we had some large corporation sales that contributed a large amount of capital gains. if we didn't have those sales, how different would that slide look?
Yes, Senator, not terribly different. These are, for one, the impact is split between 15 and 16, so it's a little bit watered down. But we're talking on the order of a couple hundred of million dollars just for these sales. I'd say around a couple hundred million is what the impact is over the 2-year period.
Senator Boquist. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to your definition on the slide of haircut.
Oh.
Right? Just to make sure I understand, because basically you get to keep the hair and sell the hair. So even though the thing's going down, that's the bottom line. As you said, we have a 10% drop, but we actually see a positive to start with, because everybody's profiteering, if you want to call it that way. And then, of course, the hangover starts up. The date of the hangover, because you used the 10% number, is this slide based on the New Year's Eve hangover at December 31st, because that's close to your 10% number, or is it actually anticipating the hangover from the month of January if it holds, which, as you know, is much larger than 10%? So what's the date time on you? I'm assuming it's last quarter information.
That's right, Senator. It's actually this year. Luckily, and I'm glad you brought this up, is that we made it to December 31st before the bad news. And so this April is baked in the cake in terms of, you know, that we made it to December 31st. So the 2015 tax year, of which people will be paying here over the next couple of months, that's still in good shape. The question is 2016 and beyond. How is that doing? And at time of production, we were down 10% from peak stock values. Now we're looking at 14 or 15, I think, as of yesterday. So, but of course, just a day or two, that could change up or down. We'll see as we go. And that's the advantage of having quarterly forecasts to try to stay on top of this. But we can't chase every day, of course, of the market. But if we do see further declines, then the revenue pain starts to get magnified, just because we get deeper into losses and away from gains.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So what do we expect this April? Well, since 2015 is locked in, it looks like we're going to have a decent April. And one of the tea leaves that we use from our accounting group is to look at estimated payments in December and January as a leading indicator of April. Typically, taxpayers with their quarterly estimated payments just don't want to pay any penalties. So they pay what they did last year. They call that safe harbor. Everything's okay. And these are usually a backward-looking indicator rather than a forward-looking indicator when we look at these estimated payments. People are reflecting how much they earned last year and how much they paid last year, except for these 2 months of the year, in December and January, when taxpayers start to call their accountants and say, I think I paid too much this year, or I'm going to have a real big bill in April, didn't pay enough. And so then they start to make these adjustments heading in just before this April payment. And in the past, as you can see here, it's a noisy indicator, but kind of gives you a good indication if we're down, up, somewhere around flat. And this year, we did see some decent 9.4% growth, which should relate into a pretty decent April. Here we are expecting 8.5% increase this April when we get our tax returns in. About half of what we saw last year, but nevertheless, still in good territory. Moving on to some of the smaller revenue items, I'll let Josh talk about the lottery and cigarettes and the like.
Real quick, we had an unexpected numbers in terms of Powerball, record-setting Powerball at the U.S., $1.5 billion jackpot, set record sales for Oregon sales. We had a week of $13 million sales and then $20 million sales in the run-up to that, things we've never seen before. That translates into about $9 million more in available resources once you pay out prizes and administrative costs and things like that we didn't have built into the forecast. we kind of have a steady jackpot in there that makes sense when you smooth out all the jackpot cycles, but that did not have a record-setting one built into it. So this is, you know, not quite half of the increase in the lottery forecast numbers you'll see in front of you. Video lottery continues to be really, really strong and showing tremendous growth, as we talked about last time. But here, the jackpot sales and the traditional products more broadly, they follow the jackpot cycles. The higher the jackpot, the higher the sales. And then we get to keep, you know, a share of that in terms of spending power for the for you guys. The next one we'll talk about another one that's been surprising across our office and our colleagues across the country are cigarette sales. Cigarette sales are on the upswing, or at least they've stopped declining in the last 12 months, maybe 18 months. You can see that here, the red line below. The red line started to flatten out and even turn up. It is not a – we don't know exactly what's going on here. It translates into about $8 more million relative to forecast, because we kind of have this slow, long-run decline built into tobacco consumption, cigarette consumption in the state of Oregon. But this is a nationwide phenomenon. It's nothing that's going on in Oregon. Washington sales are up. New Jersey sales are up, things like that, when we talk to our counterparts across the country. One of the things that we think might be going on is it could be an increase in disposable income. This is, could be some of the gasoline savings at the tank is going into some discretionary spending items. And then also the impact of the e-cigarettes came onto the marketplace a couple years ago. A lot of the consumer-based research of that shows that people don't like them. The physical product they don't like as much as the cigarettes, and so they switched over to e-cigarettes for potential health benefits or what have you. They didn't like them, and now they've gone back to the cigarettes, and so that's part of the reason why we've maybe seen an upswing. And we know that the e-cigarette industry has a backlog of inventory, their sales are down, and then we've had increased scrutiny from both federal governments and state governments and the like into the industry in terms of health benefits and regulations and taxes and things like that. So that could be another one of these potential trends that's going on. So we've had an increase in the cigarette outlook in our 10-year horizon. We don't have cigarette sales continuing to increase tremendously in the near term, a little bit. We've just kind of slowed that long-term decline moving forward. And so this is something that's certainly to keep an eye on, because it's an outlier from historical perspective. You have to go back to the early 1990s to find a time period where Oregon cigarette sales increased, and it wasn't due to tax policy shifts with Washington. Typically, if Washington raises their tax on their cigarettes, Oregon sales increase, cross-border effect of people coming and shopping over here for a lower tax rate. But right now, the tax environment's stable between the two states. I mean, we raised ours a little bit. We went up another cent, I believe, in January. But that's not going to impact cross-border sales. So you have to go back 25 years to find a time period where our sales increased and it wasn't due to Washington raising their taxes. So, again, it's a nationwide event. Our colleagues around the country are asking questions. We're trying to figure out what's going on. It's something to continue monitoring moving forward.
So adding it all up, the upshot shot for the current biennium is really still pretty stable outlook. You see here that the general fund and lottery combined resources are really virtually unchanged from the closing session forecast when the budget was drafted. So we're still pretty much on the revenue side, at least, on track with the May 2015 budget. There a little bit of details moving around in there. We've had, you know, in terms of this biennium, we do have a reduction in personal income taxes as those stocks do start to hurt us in 2016 towards the end a little bit. But that's offset by the stronger lottery numbers that Josh described. So in terms of revenue, we're just about flat on the current biennium, really, really unchanged. Whatsoever, there is a little bit more resources available, on the order of $35 or $40 million, largely because of spending adjustments as the budget folks close the books for 2015. They find a little money under the covers.
Quick question.
Back to that last slide, if you will, please, Mr. Chair. The number there you have circled, what would that number look like if we didn't have the sale of those businesses that we talked about in the capital gains that were produced by them?
Sure. The 15-17 overall forecast. It's a net. Most of it will be in this biennium, the impact of somewhere around $200 million. So if those went away, we'd be, you know, $200 million shorter. That said, we did know about those when we made the close of session forecast, so they're in there too, you know. But in the world without these events, we'd be about $200 million less, yeah, shorter. Yeah. But that those were assumed when we did the close of session forecast. The only difference is the timing. We expected more of that to be realized in 2015 than in speaking to our accountants actually happened. A lot of the events were put off until 2016, which right now is good news, given that the market's dying in 2016, that we have some additional support that's spilling over that we were expecting earlier.
I guess the reason I bring that up, Mr. Chair, is if we didn't have those, that's an anomaly in our economy, those sales of those big companies, and where we would be if that went to happen. It's like, throw that out. That's not going to happen every year. Hopefully it doesn't happen every year.
Fortunately, it happens in January right now in front of us. So
I always say it's better to be lucky than good.
That's right,
as long
Senator.
As it's positive.
Well, in a way, we do expect good events to happen, very much like the lottery jackpot forecast. There is a jackpot forecast in there. We are going to have jackpots. We are going to have businesses sell, and more now that we have baby boomers retiring, and that's tied to the overall performance of equity markets and whatnot. And so we are going to have idiosyncratic events in all of these different forecasts. There are driven by idiosyncratic events. So we do expect to have them, but we don't always expect to see record years. And this would be a record year. I don't know off the top of my head how that $200 million would compare to a normal year of sales. You know, I'd have to think a little bit deeper on that, more deeply. So in terms of the overall forecast, this is just the revenue side of things, combined lottery and general fund. You see in 15-17, the net is nothing, a $2 million up for the current biennium in terms of just the revenue impacts alone. But then there are significant declines in each of the next two biennium driven by declines in personal income tax. So we're down $166 million in 17-19 and $152 million in the following biennium. These numbers start to hurt policymakers. Next, our December forecast, which is released in November, will be the first time that these go into the governor's recommended budget, and then we'll start to see these numbers matter from where you all sit. In the out years, the stock market, impact fades away, and we get into positive territory largely because of other funds. You see corporate profits we have down across the board, but that's offset as we get forward by smaller line items. In particular, in those out years, we're expecting now a lot more OLCC revenue from liquor sales. They've increased their sales forecast from about 3% a year to 5% a year. And as that compounds, you're looking at about $65 million there in that last biennium. So it becomes some significant numbers. I'm on board with their change. It does appear that there are some taste shifts going on as millennials are in their peak drinking years now. It appears that they are moving more. it's interesting. As the baby boomers' parents liked hard alcohol more than the baby boomers
like
did.
Peak oil.
They shifted into wine and the like. It appears from early indications that the millennials are moving back into the back toward hard liquor.
Generally, it's not the state economist that's talking about the sin issues in alcohol. It's his colleague to the other side. So I do appreciate him for once taking responsibility for something.
Thank you, Senator. I'll try to be more responsible in the future. So this is the good news. Here's the good news before we leave or take questions, that is, are our budgetary reserves. Nothing better than setting up these automatic deposits that was done with the lottery in terms of the Education Stability Fund and the ending balance and corporate revenues in terms of the Rainy Day Fund. And these are starting to fill up. If Representative Reed were still with this group, he would point out to me that we still don't have enough to weather a recession by any stretch. But in terms of Oregon's history, the $800 million that we're sitting on right now is as big as our reserves have ever been, as large as ours. So this is encouraging. And if we continue to see the baseline economic outlook and revenue outlook realize itself, these are going to get even healthier going forward and reach this 7% arbitrary threshold that is used sometimes in the literature as a decent cushion for states. But again, that's even the 7% isn't enough to really fully handle a serious recession. But it's not peanuts either. And so it's encouraging that we're moving in this direction, and should help to ease the pain the next time we run into the revenue shortfall, whenever that may be. So going forward over the long run, just as always, we expect, just like with the underlying economy, for these state revenues to settle down into a more moderate growth pace than we've seen in the past, roughly 10% per biennium. There's a little wiggle here before that as we see the impact of those equity markets is already starting to show in differential weakness in terms of 17, 19, 19, 21. Rather than a straight line outlook, but nevertheless, the long run outlook is still pretty stable. That we're going to decelerate down into these sustainable levels over time, which will obviously struggle to keep up with our spending needs. So, with that, Chair Haas, we're happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. That is good news with the reserves, and I know that Representative Reed is here in spirit. that's why we have reserves. They don't happen overnight. It's been 5, 6, 7 years, and now it's up to $800 million, and that is a silver cloud compared to this dark cloud with that we're seeing for the next biennium. So, we do have some questions here, Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you either the state economist or staff remind us what the triggers are for accessing those reserves on in the Education Stability Fund and the Rating Day Fund, the triggers and the vote requirements? And the reason I ask is because there could be a difference between a downturn in revenue and a shortfall based upon underlying costs and what we're hearing about the quote shortfall in loss of federal dollars in some of our programs for next biennium.
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, the two funds that are on Mark's chart there for the budgetary reserves are the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund. The Education Stability Fund has the same triggers as the RDF is Rainy Day Fund, and those triggers are 2% or more decline in the general fund forecast compared to the close of session, two consecutive quarters of declining employment, so which would mimic a recession. Then there's another one that if it's 3% or more projected the next biennium, then that would trigger it too. So if you're in May or something and the forecast is 3% or more below the current level, and that, but there's been the other two that have gone in sync. In fact, we have a chart we just put together for the Reserve Fund Task Force. I'd be happy to give to both committees. But so those are the triggers. There's on the Education Stability Fund, there is another one that allows the governor to declare an emergency. So there, that gives an open-ended one. But the key voting element to it for the decision process is all of those triggers have an and 3/5 vote. So, and that's a constitutional stability fund, so that's a hard 3/5 requirement. Rainy Day Fund has all those same triggers except the governor's emergency, but it's statutory. So, of course, that gives more flexibility in terms of accessing it. So those are the two that, those are how the mechanisms work. We would anticipate that, we would see, and the timing is that you will tend to see the recession start to develop usually before we realize it, and then you start to realize it on the side of the shortfall, and then you're able to access the fund. The other thing I'd point out, too, about in terms of the decision process, in terms of whether you go into a special session, is that ending fund balance. And Mark has that also on there, $319 million, because that's your first line of defense. And, you know, because if the forecast goes down by $200 million next time, then you've still got $119 million ending balance. So that's your automatic, that's your contingency that works automatically.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the presentation. But I do have a couple of questions. You should already have anticipated this, because like Representative Reed, I generally go back to the same things. But I do appreciate that the first 20 slides outline Shangri-La, and things are great. But I've got a couple of technical questions here, because I'm not confused, but whatever. You were very adamant that, you know, higher wage job growth is just skyrocketing. Things are great. We'll argue in a minute about rural areas. Some of us don't think a city of 84,000, which is in your statistics, is being rural, or a city of 78,000. But with all these higher wage jobs going up, two questions for you, and everything is so great. Why, and is it just the demographics? First question, why is personal income going to go down if wages are skyrocketing and jobs are plentiful? And the second thing is, why would we need a $15 minimum wage if there's so many high-paying jobs, or the high-paying jobs are going to be the $15 minimum wage?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, most of what we're talking about is, of course, average wages, or when we talk about a decline in personal income, that's average relative to the U.S. And that number, people have gone away from really highlighting that, because it talks a lot about weird technical things with proprietor's income or income, and of course the per capita problem, with the fact that we have a lot of retirees and a lot of people moving here, make, you know, put weight on this. But I think the takeaway in terms of our average income and our average wage is that we really did get hammered when we closed all the mills in the 1980s. And we recovered some of that back in our tech boom in the 90s, but we're still feeling that, you know, in terms of where we stand relative to other states. And that's very mostly felt in the mill towns. You know, mill towns, obviously, a lot of them haven't come back and are not seeing, you know, wage gains that compare. But as Josh mentioned, it's surprising, because this is something that our when we show the average wages and we show our withholding numbers and all the Oregon wage numbers and say, oh my goodness, you know, we're leading the country here. Everywhere else was waiting for wage gains, and we had them, and now everywhere else is starting to get them, and we've had even stronger wage gains. This is great. Our advisor said, well, what, you know, maybe this is just a mix. Is it just, you know, because everybody's moving to Portland, it makes it look like wages are higher because wages are higher there, or because we're only getting these high-end jobs and a few of them, and it's averages, you're pulling everybody else up. But in looking in the details, it really is, there is growth across every industry and, you know, across every region. There is some positive trend here, and we are seeing some improvement in wages, as we should, as labor becomes more and more scarce. We're going to see some growth, but that doesn't mean where we are is necessarily high or low. And we know that across the state, there are certainly real disparities in the level of average wages or the median wage or any other pay indicator we look at.
Follow up.
Generally, when we get the doom and gloom at the end of session, right? You have, fortunately or unfortunately, have a lot more slides, and you do show those sectors. So, are there sectors in which the growth is more pronounced? I'm trying to use economic terms, because growing 1%, you know, and growing 10%, there's a lot of difference, especially if it's a low-paying sector. So, are there sectors in which are more accounted for example, healthcare sector, of course the tech market's not doing well, but are there sectors that are experiencing more growth and more wage growth? And what is the general geographic and demographics of those growths? And what I mean is, are those really city, or are they rural or suburban, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Senator Boquist, Chair Haas, I think, and I'll have Josh chime in, but in terms of growth leaders, in wages. We've seen a lot in terms of professional and service, professional and business services, a wide range of them, you know, accounting, IT, legal services, the like. These have all done pretty well over the last year or two in terms of leading wage growth. We've also seen encouraging wages in manufacturing and goods production. Again, the threats are looking at us, but we certainly have seen some upward pressure there as well. But again, it's across all industries, some less so than others, but we are seeing pretty broad-based wage gains.
That's right. And the one thing I will add, Senator Boqvist, based on a data request that came into our office a few weeks ago, and I was surprised by this, they were asking about differential wage growth in the Portland metropolitan area. And the professional technical services category, which is your office workers, your law offices and your consultants and all the people that are in the high rises, their average wage gains, and this is over 10 years, have matched almost perfectly the average wage gain for all sectors, all private sectors in Portland, right? So your offices, your people you think that work in high rises, at least stereotypically, their average wage growth over the last 10 years has nearly matched the overall private sector within the Portland economy. And I was surprised by that. I thought I would see the white collar office workers substantially higher than everyone else, or, you know, because of the mix and the balance. But that wasn't the case. Statewide, I'm not sure if you'd see more differentials, and, you know, maybe in Eugene it's different or something like that. I don't know. But that's just something off the shelf that we had done recently, and I was surprised by the results.
One final question.
Senator Boqvist, Representative Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to the export slide. And how much of that decline is due to the strong dollar, as you mentioned, but how much of it could be due to the fact that we've had some real issues with the Port of Portland with actually being able to get exports out of there, and some of these may have gone to other ports that actually were more functional? Does that play a role in that number at all?
Yes, Representative Johnson, Chair Haas, a small role, but in terms of the trouble at the Port of Portland, it's mostly talking about the containers, mm-hmm. which aren't a large part, particularly in the way this is measured. This chart is measured in terms of the value of exports, mm-hmm. and so it misses a lot when you have a huge barge full of grain or whatever it is, right? That creates a lot of economic activity and a lot of port activity and ancillary transportation, warehousing, stuff like that. But it's not as valuable as, say, a bag of semiconductors. And so in terms of these overall swings, I would say very little impact on these numbers from the port. Not that the port isn't having an impact, but that's the decline here, I think, is all about terms of trade.
Okay. And I will add, they try their best to mark the products back to where they come from. Okay. So when stuff gets railed in from Wyoming, and then it comes out of the Port of Portland or what have you, or maybe up out of Longview or something, or SeaTac. They tried their hardest to code that back to Wyoming exports, and it doesn't show up as Oregon. You know, we're trying to isolate just Oregon products here. That's what they're trying to do. So they try their best.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much appreciate the conversation that you've been having with Senator Boqvist about this issue of disaggregating these numbers. One of the conversations we've had in the House Revenue Committee constantly is the best way to measure central tendency, and usually it's not the average. And I think his comment about that one point earlier on today, I think, illustrates the point really pretty well. I really appreciate it when you present disaggregated numbers so that we can help. Not only are we interested in, I think, in the revenue estimate for the state's revenue, but also the overall trends in the economy and the movements in the economy. And those don't usually come in aggregate numbers. They come in disaggregated numbers, either using the median, when that's a better measure of central tendency, or simply disaggregation of different industries or different age groups or different regions or what have you. And I have to tell you, when you do that, I appreciate it very much. I think it gives us much richer data. Now, I know that sometimes you can't, because the data, the basic information from which you could do that doesn't exist. But when you can, I think it's really useful for us, not only to understand the issues that this committee and the Revenue Committee are interested in, but also the issues that the legislature is interested in more generally. And that's just a comment as you do. One final, if I may, Mr. Chair, is I greatly appreciate reading the blogs that I've now been getting an email connection to lately. Those have been extremely useful. And the most recent one, of course, prefigured some of the information you gave us this morning about what parts of the economy look like they're doing better and what parts worse and why that might be. And I appreciate that very much.
Representative Barnhart, thanks for the kind words. I would encourage you, obviously, for the time purposes, we couldn't put everything, all of our good stuff here today, but in the forecast document, I'd encourage you to look. We do have some breakdown across regions, across the industries, and some of the stuff I think you're pointing to, we do have in the written document, but didn't bring with us today. But thank you so much,
Senator Bertschiger Jr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I'd like you to expand on a little bit, and you haven't done that, and that's commodities. Commodities are very important for rural Oregon. And when you look at commodities right now, there's a lot of things going on, but between the strong dollar, a lot of supply of commodities, a lot of carryover from last year, a lot of good crops in other countries and stuff like that. I mean, we've seen cattle prices somewhere in the neighborhood of 20-25% drop in one year. So could you expand a little bit where you think we're going in rural Oregon, given these commodity problems?
Yes, Senator. It's obviously not good for the typical commodity, agricultural commodity and the like, that which is more important to us are the agricultural commodities, because we're not, you know, we don't do the mining or the energy in any large way. And all of those really saw drops that were very much coordinated with the drops in energy prices at the same time. And like you say, typically 20-25% across the board for our larger commodities. So this obviously isn't good. You know, as goes the price of wheat, so goes Pendleton. This, you know, for a lot of our rural areas, this is a concern. But that said, of any industry that knows how to deal with a couple of good years and then followed by a couple of bad ones, it would be ranchers and farmers and ag, because this is not new. Commodity prices are very volatile, and typically they're used to getting blown around by the winds of these things over time. But yeah, obviously we're not heading into a good couple of years right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for what is always one of the best presentations of the month, if not the entire quarter. I'd like to go back to slide 11 regarding labor force participation. And could you remind us what you mean first by participation mostly structural? Add to that what has exacerbated the problem. And, you know, you guys never respond, wisely so, when we ask you for policy guidance, but explain the problems that go into the low labor participation rates, and perhaps as policymakers we can think about some solutions.
All right, Josh, you want to do the textual?
The word structural here should be probably interchanged with demographic, just due to the aging of the baby boomers, particularly over the last 15, 20 years. Even, again, the dotted gray line is, even if everything was operating at full capacity, firing on all cylinders, we would still have a declining labor force participation rate over the last 15 years and even over the next 10 years, just due to the aging of the population. We have a whole lot more people in their retirement years than we've seen in generations, obviously, with the aging of the baby boomers. And this measure is calculated everyone that's 16 years and older. It doesn't make an age adjustment at the top end, right? It doesn't cut off people that are 65 or 75 and older or anything like that. So that's why you see the decline. Some of the specific differences among the ages, even in the prime working age is 25 to 54 generally. These are the people that typically 80% of them are in the labor force, something like that. In the youngest group, we've seen an increase in college enrollments, So the labor force participation has declined among the youngest group because we've seen an uptick in college enrollments. That should be a good thing over the long run, provided they attain a degree, hopefully with not too much student debt either. If they do obtain a degree, that makes theoretically makes them more productive worker moving forward, so that's a silver lining. In the middle age group, so you're talking, you know, your mid-30s through 50, somewhere in that ballpark, we've seen an increase in people claiming or saying that they are ill or disabled, not necessarily on Social Security insurance disability, but just, you know, the reason I'm not looking for work, I have a bad back or something along those lines. We also have seen an increase in early retirements, which probably is more business cycle related, a weak economy, they can't find a job, so they're just gonna bunker down and say they're retired. And then of course, as you get into the older age, you've actually seen an increase in labor force participation rate among people 60 and 70 years old. But again, that's going from 15% of them in the labor force to 18% of them in the labor force, right? Once you hit in your 60s and your 70s, the vast majority people aren't working, even though those trends are on the rise, it's still a small number. And so I'd say those are some of the biggest changes in terms of the compositional effect of this by the different age groups. And then also among the young group, not only in college, but once you get into your late 20s through your early 30s or your 30s, we've seen an increase in people taking care of home and family. We've seen an uptick in stay-at-home parents. Both, almost vast majority of them are stay-at-home moms. The stay-at-home dads have doubled from zero to double of zero, based on data. But the swings are on the uptrend. I think the narrative has gotten ahead of the conventional wisdom has gotten ahead of the data on that point. But again, and then how much of the stay-at-home parent is also economic related? If you had a $60,000 job waiting for you, would you still be taking care of your family? Some would, some wouldn't, because of the cost of daycare and things like that. So it's hard to disentangle some of the business effects and the economic effects from personal choices and personal trends and societal trends. But these are some of the bigger components that are impacting this.
But in terms of the potential impact on the economy, there are really two ones that are the most concerning. One are these youngest workers. Traditionally, these young workers change jobs a lot, and they get experience, and they hop around, and they get soft skills and everything else, and seeing a lot less, even in the pre-college years, you know, in the teenage years, we're seeing a lot less. And that, I think that's a concern for the long-run productivity of our workforce. And the other one is simply the traditional recession problem, which are skills mismatch. If I'm a middle-aged mill worker pulling down a good salary out in rural Oregon, the mill closes, my skills no longer match with the local economy. I become, you know, disengaged and pull away, and those are permanent damage. You know, we've lost permanent capacity, and so that's the traditional one.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to kind of conclude on Chair Barnhart's comment too, because he's exactly what I'm driving at. And I know you're not going to answer my question, but I'll just restate my first question. And there is a complete disconnect between Shangri-La and Happy Days or here again in high wages and a downturn in 2 to 4 years in personal income for tax collections. And if I said your statement to my seniors and millennials in my district, they'd say you're nuts, because the seniors are working older, and the millennials don't agree with your forecast, and I'm going to hear it at the dinner table tonight, just so you know. But having said that, in the future, having more detailed information for us as policymakers, we have evolved in the 12 years I've nearly been here, and I started on revenue with actually half the committee sitting here. And, you know, it's the Tax and Revenue Policy Committee, and we seem to have moved to making the presentation as a joint ways and means spending policy. Here's the money, go spend it. Our problem in the policymaker and the information we need and the public needs to see in order to support us to make the decisions, in my mind, I may be wrong and the two chairs can say I'm wrong, that's fine, is that we see personal income is going to go down in 2 to 4 years, and we got to figure out how to get it going back up like this. And with that, we need that weeds data that Representative Barnhart saying is, okay, what sectors are doing well, what sectors are not doing well, because again, the broad scope is fine, but if I go to Al-C, and I think you know where Al-C is, they don't think Bend, who is quote rural, is at 84,000 is rural. If I go to
to Monroe in my district, they don't think Medford at 78,000 is rural either. Mm. And so, likewise, I'm just saying more detailed data on these industrial sectors, because in tax policy, even though everybody back on both sides jumps up and down, we're trying to make tax policy that says we want more of these types of jobs. That's the reality of the fix. Or we want less of these types, or we're willing to spend expenditure, whatever. And I'm just asking you that, since I don't think Shangri-La is here, and obviously near 2 and 4 out in front of us, you've said it's not here, the more detail in those arenas that help us as policymakers would be more helpful.
Certainly, Senator Boquist. If the chairs agree, we will flood you with minute details next time.
Useful.
Gentlemen, I concur with Representative Davis. This is a very thorough presentation and most helpful. So thank you once again. We'll see you in 3 months.
Thank you all.
Not sooner. Thanks to the House members who joined us here today. Yep. And the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue will adjourn. Yep. And the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue will adjourn.